Hi, my name is Cecilia Poonar, and welcome to this episode of Brave New Women. All around the world, there are amazing, ordinary women doing extraordinary things. Brave New Women is about giving those women a platform and a voice, and it's about changing the way that women are perceived. And it's a way of inspiring all of us to do the things that we've always wanted to do. Today, I'm thrilled to be talking to Stacey Tericcio and Brooke Swain. Stacey and Brooke work together at Rebellion Energy in Oklahoma. Stacey is the president and CEO, and Brooke is the senior engineering and geological technician. They are also both co-founders of Fellow Environmental Partners, which is a non-profit which focuses on plugging orphaned oil and gas wells in an effort to reduce methane emissions. So Stacey and Brooke, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, Stacey, how and why did you become an oil and gas engineer?
Such a great question, and one that I get asked pretty often. I don't have any family in the industry, and that's often how people do kind of get an introduction. I did play soccer. I grew up in Tulsa, and I played soccer growing up and went to the University of Tulsa on a soccer scholarship. And as I got there, I kind of looked around and thought to myself, if I'm going to go to school here, I want to do the thing that this school is the best at. And in Tulsa, that's petroleum engineering. So my degree's in petroleum engineering, and the University of Tulsa has a world-renowned petroleum engineering school.
Right. And Brooke, you?
I got into oil and gas. Well, I do have, several... grandparents, great grandparents, folks in my family that have been in oil and gas. And I, growing up in Oklahoma, that's just a large industry in our state. I took my first job because I wanted to work in acquisitions and on projects. And I thought that it was exciting and there's so much to learn in oil and gas. I knew I would never be bored. So.
And how many women are there in the industry?
More and more as time has gone by. I can't give you an exact number, of course, but it's, with everything else, it's the same. It starts out with quite a few kind of entry-level women in these positions. There are probably more women in the financial and accounting positions, sort of the kind of back office positions, less in maybe engineering and geosciences. And then, as you kind of move up the ladder, I think some of the women, the percentage of women fall off. Certainly that's the case when I started. It has gotten a lot different over time. Really, I think oil and gas companies have done a pretty good job of having awareness around sort of what women bring to the table and including them and sponsoring, even at very early education levels, things like STEM and focuses on geosciences. So I think constant improvement there and certainly more room to go. But I have a great network of women in positions in the C-suite or management positions throughout industry that is, of course, invaluable.
And you yourself, Stacey, have you got a particular specialization?
I do. So like I said, my engineering degree is petroleum engineering. So even within petroleum engineering, there's sort of reservoir engineering, which is focusing very much on quantifying the amount of hydrocarbons within the ground. And then there's production engineering, which is more mechanically oriented. How do we get those reserves out? And then even more specialized than that, there are very specific drilling engineers that design and work the equipment that we use to drill and complete wells. So my focus has always been very much on the reservoir side.
And Brooke, have you got a particular specialization?
I don't. I move around a lot and do just special projects. So a little bit of everything.
That's actually what makes Brooke so exceptional at what she does is she's got a lot of great geosciences expertise. She's done a ton on the engineering side, all facets of engineering, operational and reservoir. And she's also very good on the data side as well, which is, of course, can't live without.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me?
The bulk of my career has been in like acquisitions and divestitures and special projects, but varies.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one or other of you could jump in and just tell me a bit about Rebellion Energy. What does Rebellion Energy do? How many of you are there?
Tell me I'll take that one, and then I'll let Brooke answer when we start talking about Fellow a little more. But for Rebellion Energy, it's a private equity backed company. And so a little bit like flipping houses, I guess, if you will. We started out about 5 years ago in what's called the Mid-Continent in the United States. So focused on kind of the Oklahoma region. And there's an area there specifically called the Scoop Stack. And so we built up an asset there, got to about 30 people on that asset, actually bought the asset out of a bankruptcy process. And then built that up, drilled several wells. And then, like I said, think of flipping houses. Once it's sort of proven up, we sell it to another entity. We actually rolled that one into Camino Natural Resources, who is still a great team working the asset in the Scoop Stack. And then for our next iteration with the same capital partners, we sort of recapitalized and went up to the Powder River Basin, which is in Wyoming. Very similar, again, subsurface. So shale play, heavy emphasis on pressure and rock quality, built that asset up and have spent the last 2 years, 2.5 years up there and are in the process right now of exiting that asset. So we're down to, you know, you build up people as you build the companies and then you kind of scale back down as you're exiting and scale back up. There's some of that comes with the territory here. And so I would say we've gone from as many as 30 people to as many as, you know, 8 or 10 people on any given kind of time frame of asset.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you actually, is it oil? Is it gas? Is it, what is it that you're special with?
Almost always when you produce one, you get the other as well. And so we sort of focus on the natural gas side. Not because it's natural gas necessarily, but because we focus on high pressure assets, and high pressure assets are often in areas where the primary phase is gas. And so there are instances, however, where you make more oil out of a gas well than you do out of an oil well. So primary phase is kind of how we talk about that, and ours is most often gas.
And so what Rebellion Energy is doing is pulling together teams of people to be able to buy and exploit and then exit a particular asset.
Yes, that's right. And a lot of people take that and do it differently. There are some teams that are very focused on the land acquisition piece. Our company has historically been very subsurface oriented. So lots of geoscientists and reservoir engineers kind of guiding where we buy land. And for example, we would be more interested in spending more money on land that we know to have good, high quality rock. Whereas another team may spend a lot less, but get a lot more land and maybe it's a lower quality rock. So right, there are different strategies in how you approach that.
Mm-hmm. And Brooke, maybe you could just jump in and tell me about Fellow Environmental Partners. How did that start?
Sure. It started a little less than a year ago, I would say. We just incorporated in April, but we became really passionate about the subject. And as we looked to, you know, of course, COVID happened. And everything changed. And we love the oil and gas industry. But we have a group of people that love working together, and we kind of were like, what do we want to do next? Not the same thing. Where could we go? You know, and so after throwing around several different ideas, we started looking at like the end of well life and studying abandoned wells. And I personally, that's when I really learned the depth of the orphaned well issue and started learning more about methane emissions and water contamination and more from the landowner perspective and all these different stakeholders. And as we went to learn more about it, we talked to all these different experts, but they felt very siloed. And so everyone has been wonderful to work with, but it feels like nobody really has the answer and nobody really has a firm grasp. What's happening? How can we quantify this? What's the solution? You know? And so we were like, why isn't everybody working on this together? And so one night I just remember Stacy said, we should start a nonprofit. That would be really hard. And I was like, that would be hard, but I think we have to do that. Yep. That's just kind of how it started in my version anyway.
And what is the problem with end of life with the oil and gas wells?
I think there's probably a variety of issues. I mean, you know, as we learn more about wellbore integrity and, you know, I mean, these materials do have a life that we're using, you know, and so cement, different types, but let's say cement, what would you say, Stacey, a 30-year life or so on average?
Yeah. Gosh, I mean, it's such a hard question because there are all kinds of things that are potential issues with
right,
oil
right.
wells that are no longer producing, with oil and gas wells that are producing, but it becomes a much more important conversation when those wells are not providing any sort of positive right. benefit energy. And so when those wells stop producing, you've kind of got this asset that's just left in the ground that may or may not be causing environmental or social impacts, right? And so when you start talking about social impacts, it gets a little harder to quantify there, right? Like if there is a abandoned well, by abandoned, I mean a not producing well. If there's a well that's no longer producing and it's, you know, in a school playground, there's some real obvious things that come to mind there, you know, not the least of which is you don't want a child, you know, being harmed by any of this equipment that's on location. So the social stuff is a little harder to quantify. What we have decided to focus on, at least initially, are the environmental impacts.
Can I just ask you a question about the social? So, could you have an oil well in the middle of a playground?
No, that was probably an exaggeration.
Well, I mean, you will find them in a school parking lot or under someone's house, or people find these wells sometimes because they detect gas later, not knowing it's there. We haven't had any regulation to plug these wells, you know, for hundreds of years before. You know, we were drilling for hundreds of years before we ever had regulation to plug. And so they're just not all documented. We don't know. We could build something and not know that it's there.
Okay. Yeah. So the permitting process sort of is where you navigate that. And you can't at this point go to a jurisdictional body and say, we want to drill a well and it happens to be in a parking lot. That is sort of not allowed anymore. But, you know, there are all these legacy assets that were drilled 50 years ago. And those are the ones that are really problematic in that regard. Those are often also the ones that are orphaned. And so the social impact of orphan wells is oftentimes magnified because you didn't even know an orphan well existed in that space. So if we're all kind of comfortable/uncomfortable with that part of it, the environmental side is things like methane emissions. And we mean fugitive emissions here, from leaks, from valves, from connections, things like that. Even coming up through, you know, the wellbore kind of has, you know, steel casing in it. So if there's any kind of failure mechanism in that casing, you could have it coming up through, potentially groundwater. So there's groundwater contamination. The equipment on site can have kind of norm radioactive materials associated with it in some instances. And so those are the things that we can go out and measure. And that's really where you find a lot of alignment with oil and gas is it's a lot easier to have a conversation around something that you can measure and quantify. And so we can measure methane emissions. There are a lot of ways to measure it. And there's probably some standardization that needs to happen there for consistency purposes. But you can go out and measure that. So you can quantify and scale that issue. There are same with groundwater contamination. It's a little harder, but you can go out and take water samples from wells in the area or from water bodies in the area and try to begin to understand that. Same with equipment on surface, right there, even if it's just a visual inspection. Those are some of the impacts that we see that are quantifiable. The social ones are less quantifiable, but equally important, equally, if not more so important. And that's really where we see ourselves as fellow differentiated from a lot of these other entities that want to plug wells. We aren't in a position at this point with the set of data that we have to say, blanketly, all wells emit methane, or all wells have groundwater contamination, or even how much. Is it nominal or is it really material? We don't have enough information yet. We don't have a representative enough data set yet to say that. And that is really the first step. All of these conversations need to really be founded in kind of scientific and measured data so that we can, you know, you can't say, you could say it, but it's very difficult for an oil and gas company to go out and plug all of the wells that it has ever drilled, right? That's a big capital ask and even just a time ask. So what we really need to do is create tools by which they can prioritize that work so that we're really mitigating the most important social or environmental impacts sooner, right? And sort of provide tools to, of course, mitigate risk, but also really proactively approach this. And that's the hard part, right? That's the part that requires some complex thought and prioritization, but even more importantly, it requires data to get there. And that's where we see opportunity to step in and help.
How many wells are we talking about?
Millions. So on the orphaned well front, each state, I'll talk just about the United States, you know, multiply that by X amount for other countries. For the United States, where we are focused, each state manages its own orphan well program. So in Oklahoma, for example, there are anywhere from 15 to 20,000 orphan wells that are documented. Again, you have a potentially serious problem with the undocumented orphan wells, right? So, you know, multiply that by however much you think is appropriate. You know, Texas is probably a little less, varies from state to state, but just based on that Oklahoma number, I would say thousands of orphan wells that need to be plugged.
What does an oil well look like? And how do you find them if they're abandoned?
A great question. It can look,
yeah, it varies. Sometimes you'll see, you know, a big pump. Sometimes you'll see batteries of tanks. Sometimes you'll just see pipes sticking out of the ground. Sometimes you won't see them. And there may be a depression in the ground or some wooden casing you wouldn't have detected otherwise. Lots of foliage growing over it. And so you can detect them with various different, you know, tools, whether you're flying over, with in a helicopter, you know, or using a drone or just walking a field, with handheld monitors or, you know, there's some new continuous monitoring technology that's coming out that has solar and cellular and, various different ways of finding and detecting.
One of the things we've actually thrown around recently, Brooke and I, about a potential project for Fellow is going back through, you know, we've had this shift in the last 20, 30 years from paper to digital. And so there are places, for example, there's a log library in Tulsa where all of those paper records are available. Not all, but a lot of paper records are available. And either no one knows how to go back through that record or doesn't have the time or, you know, the will or the way. And so we've thought a lot recently about getting a bunch of interns to go through that information and try to either digitize it for later use or go through and capture as much as they can that's useful to us in this moment. We talk about that a lot because really that is a problem that is going to continue to get worse, right? The people that are available to really sift through that data the way it should be sifted through are going away, right? They're no longer working or transitioning out in some way. And so really sort of the time is now if we'd like to do a project like that. And we've talked about it quite a bit recently.
Yeah, one of my grandfathers was a surveyor for oil and gas fields, and he's got just all these notebooks full of, you know, handwritten pencil footages, and you know, the state websites have some information. It's one of the best data sets to use, but we don't have those all pulled together. That's an effort we're working on, and some subscription data sets and old maps from operators. just a variety of sources that we can use.
Who were running these oil wells? Were they just like one man bands, or were they little, you know, families, or were they little companies, or who was digging them and, you know, pulling the oil out of the ground?
Unfortunately, all of the above is the answer. I think if the oil and gas community, you know, the oil and gas community sort of catches a lot of flack, and sometimes it's substantiated and sometimes it isn't. But I think the one thing that most oil and gas folks and most oil and gas companies sort of cringe at is this orphan well issue. It's something that I don't think we're proud of. I think we recognize that that wasn't handled appropriately. And we recognize that we all probably had a part to play there. And so the good news is there's alignment on that, right? The bad news is it happened from mom and pop operators. It happened all the way up through independents, through privately held companies, on up to majors. And, you know, it's not something that people set about to do, right? They didn't, you know, there wasn't anyone standing around that said, you know what, I'm going to try and get away and not plug this well. That's not what happened. What happened is, there are so many wells, just the sheer magnitude of this issue. And as people went through transitions and as companies exchanged hands or merged, and as data sets were then combined or digitized, you sort of lose track, and these things have slipped through the cracks for far too long. And really it's an industry and a regulatory body problem. And I think one that, again, the industry is aligned, to try and work towards a solution on.
It sounds to me like it's an absolutely massive problem, because if you've got millions of these abandoned oil and gas wells that are contaminating groundwater, that are leaking methane. And I understand that methane is a far more toxic climate change gas than even CO2.
Depending on how you look at it, it could be like 84 times more potent than
wow. Yeah. And so don't take from this, though, that every well is emitting methane, or that every well is contaminating groundwater. And really, that's what we don't know is... If we, just to throw a number out there, if there are 1 million orphan wells out there that are no longer producing, we just don't have enough information yet to tell us which of those wells are potential hazard, which of those wells have associated risks. If there are associated risks, what is the scale of that risk? And maybe that matters less. I understand that. But, there's simply not enough information out there to capture this problem in a way that helps us work towards solutions. And that is really, really at the heart of this issue is, you know, this conversation around ESG, specifically the environmental piece, is emerging, you know, over the last 10 years. And so we're having to go back and solve problems that were created well before this happened. And that's a hard thing to do, especially, again, with the scale of wells that you're talking about. It's quite difficult to sift through.
And it is an expensive problem. Like, we need to give people the information to make them deploy the capital to do this. You know, you can spend anywhere from, say, $15,000 to $1 million to plug a well. You know, the majority of them, like right now, there's still work being done on the costs, but right now, like, we're anchoring to roughly $24,000 US dollars a well bore to plug. And that's not counting, you know, remediating the surface. You know, that's probably another $10,000 or more.
Right.
What do you actually do when you plug a well? What does it involve?
It involves, so I'm going to use some terms you may or may not be familiar with, but it involves bringing in what's called a workover rig, which is a very big, kind of clunky piece of equipment that has a carbon footprint of its own, right? So you're transporting this out there, putting it on location. You go in and you remove the tubulars, and that's like the pipe that has supported this wellbore and you've produced out of it. So you remove those. You want to make sure that the integrity of the remaining wellbore is good. And so you kind of do what's called cleanup of the wellbore, which basically means there are no cracks or collapses of the leftover casing. And so once you've done all of that work, you can move that workover rig over and you can come in with a different kind of rig that's a little less clunky, but you can go in and set your plugs that way. So you actually have to bring the workover rig back on because you are pumping cement down into the wellbore through the tubing and then sort of back and forth with those two pieces of equipment moving up the wellbore. So you really want to make sure your perforations, which is where you're accessing the actual hydrocarbons at subsurface, you want to make sure those are plugged back because you have to stop that conduit. You have to go up and make sure that your groundwater is protected. So you're setting plugs at multiple intervals throughout this wellbore. And really, like I said, it's some clunky equipment and it's a pretty clunky process. It's something that we've been doing the same way for about 70 years now, right? And this is an industry of people that are incredibly technical, incredibly capable from an engineering and problem-solving perspective. And really, this process has had zero attention over the last 70 years. And so even just a focus on it from kind of a technical perspective, I think we'll begin to improve that process tremendously, with the end goal being let's make it more efficient to plug these wells, certainly from a capital perspective. So hopefully strides will be made in that direction because of companies like us kind of pushing focus.
Mm-hmm. Because I can imagine that if you're putting cement down there, that cement is actually going to last for a certain amount of time. So does that mean that in every 25 years, you're going to have to be coming back in and then?
It's a great question. The quantity of cement that we put down a wellbore is substantial. And so really, I think that the hold is probably there for the most part. Now, when we start talking about seismicity, that can cause issues, I suppose. And when we start talking about, completing wells nearby, especially with fracking techniques, you may frack into something, I suppose. So there are a number of reasons that cement maybe is not the best solution. And that's something, again, our group is focused on kind of innovative materials and things like that, that we can really begin to improve this process. There's also kind of the reclamation side on the land at the surface after you've plugged the well, right? And there you're talking about conforming the land back to what it was previously, including things like moving dirt around, making sure any spill was properly cleaned up, excavating pipe in some instances, or at least reclaiming it where it was. There are a lot of different things that have to be done there.
Yeah, you typically would create like roads to drill a well and create pits and a variety of things that aren't just the well bore.
So creating kind of this full cycle asset retirement thing is a work in progress. I would say you really need to make sure you've gone the full gamut of not only removing equipment, but all the way through to reseeding it so that you don't just have sort of neglected dirt laying out on the ground, right? Like you have to have, whether it's reforestation or reseeding, you really want to make sure that there's a carbon sequestration opportunity happening that is at least as good as what existed there beforehand. Mm-hmm. A lot of these wells also exist in farming communities. And so, those are acres that farmers can use to create food, to grow food.
Mm-hmm. And animals.
Mm-hmm. And you said that it can cost anywhere upward of $24,000 to plug a well. So where's the cash coming from? I mean, that's, so if you're talking about millions of wells and some of them are costing a million, I mean, that's a very large amount of money.
Yeah, $24,000 a well is, I don't think it's a minimum number to plug a well, but it's probably average. The problem is you have 80% of the wells out there can probably be plugged for $20,000 to $60,000, let's say. And then you have the other 20% that have some pretty serious issues. And those can be hundreds of thousands of dollars or $1 million right there. Those are problem wells. So kind of understand those two buckets, I guess, first of all, and more work really does need to be done there to maybe not maybe not capture that. I think oil and gas companies have a pretty big handle on that, but communicate that back out to the public. More work should be done on that part.
Yeah. And based on the region that you're in, you know, I mean, there are other states in the US where you could average, you know, over 100,000 per well.
Yeah. But where is the money coming from was your next question. For orphaned wells specifically, that money is coming from taxpayers. Each state has their own program by which they use state funding to plug wells. And those programs vary quite a lot, I would say, from state to state. Some of them are incredibly efficient, I would assume, and some of them have a lot of work that needs to be done there. But really, again, what can we do to help states manage that risk along the way, right? Right now, it's sort of, let's pick that well over there because it kind of looks messier, or, right, there's not a lot of work that's been done to put states in a position to use those taxpayer dollars efficiently. And that needs to happen, I would say, across the board for states and for operators.
So how does Fellow work with, say, for example, Oklahoma State? What's the relationship between Fellow and the state?
Sure. So we really need to sit alongside the state and supplement their process. And I mean supplement their process from a monetary perspective, but also from a data perspective. Again, these are very old wells. The documentation is probably not wholesome or complete in any way. And so we need to supplement there as well. But the states typically do a pretty good job of making sure that they're employing local service providers and doing that in an equitable way. The states do a pretty decent job of listening to landowners that have immediate issues on a well site. And so I don't see our job as disrupting that process. I think there are some things we can add to create efficiencies, but really we need to sit alongside the state and be, you know, be a support for them.
So we're calling different state agencies and saying, hi, what can we do to support you? What would be helpful to you? And we're sharing information back and forth with them, some that they don't have, some that we, you know, don't have. And providing more resources for them is crucial.
Okay, so Fellow is providing the data and the information. And who's actually going out and, you know, putting the rig on the top and pouring down the cement? Is that the state, or is that?
So the state would have ownership of the well, or Fellow could have ownership of the well, and we would bid that work out to service providers in the community. And so, like I said, different states do it differently, but some of them have a list of sort of qualified operators, qualified service providers that they kind of roll through. But yes, there are plugging and abandonment service providers that the state then uses, or that Fellow would then use to do the actual work on the wells.
Mm-hmm. And who are the other people involved in Fellow?
So we have a big group.
We've got, we're really pretty new. And last time I checked, I think we have folks from like 30 different organizations between our board. There's, you know, some of us are operators or service providers or academics or landowner representatives, financial people, carbon market people. That's something we haven't talked about, is the carbon offsets incentives we're working on. But you have to have regulatory experts and operations experts, bunch of engineers, attorneys and environmental agencies, and from the perspective of people who have a large group of resources, to also, we've got to work with groups that are, you know, rural farmers, sharing their perspectives with us. You know, that's key. So we're a motley crew of different, you know, stakeholders.
On our board, we have representation from an operator. We have a CEO. His name's John Mark Beaver from 89 Energy, and he runs an operating company. We have a spectacular academic. Her name's Amy Townsend Small. She's one of very few people that have done significant work and published papers on this methane emissions issue. And so she's a great advisor to us kind of on that environmental impact side. We also have sort of financial and nonprofit representation on our board. And then, like Brooke said, we have some carbon offset market expertise, as well as some service provider expertise coming from a man named Benjamin Pitsley, who runs the Summit Companies in the U.S. out of Utah. So probably ever-growing and ever-changing. Dogs. But a great board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if people wanted to get involved in Fellow, are you looking for any particular qualifications, or how can they get involved?
My perspective is that every single one of us is affected by this. And so every single person, I've yet to meet someone who doesn't have something valuable to contribute. Reach out to us. We would love, we're big on being inclusive and not all having the same thought and experience. And, we have a website that's fellowenviro.org that has like a, stay in touch. We have an email address that's info@fellowenviro.org. There's a phone number on our website. Just reach out.
I mean, it sounds to me like it's a problem that until a few weeks ago, I had no idea about it, but it's actually a massive, massive, massive problem for all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, and I'm with you. I mean, a year ago when we started studying this, I threw some wells on a map and I just had like tabular data. And so we linked it up to GIS, and like the first place I looked was my parents' house. They live in a subdivision, and there were like four orphan wells on the list within their square mile. Then I looked at like my grandparents' farm. Well, of course, that's rural, so there's going to be wells, orphan wells out there. I looked at my son's school on old records, and there's a record of like a well being there, but then there was never a record of it being plugged, but there's no real sign of it. You know, it's like they're all over the place. And even when you drive by to try to find them, you may not see them. So I was in your same spot a year ago. It's easy. They're a little bit hidden. And we're hoping to provide a little bit more information out there and communicate a little bit better about
it. I wanted to go back and say specifically one place we feel like we're a bit deficient from a representation perspective is on the diversity and inclusion piece. Really, we have a committee and we need to fill that out in a meaningful way. It's so difficult, not to just check a box on that topic and to really bring in people whose perspectives are valuable. All perspectives are valuable, but maybe a little more relative to this topic. And that's been a hard thing for us to do. I don't know why. Maybe it's a testament to kind of our individual bubbles. I don't know, but I do think that we have some room for improvement there. Mm-hmm. And I think most importantly, we don't want to sort of force our opinion that every well needs to be plugged into this space if that's not the case. We may have farmers that don't want to plug that well for a reason that we don't understand, and we really need that perspective as we prioritize wells to be plugged and really thinking about it from an environmental justice space. There's room for improvement on our part there. And so anybody that's interested in particular on that piece, we would love to hear from.
Mm-hmm. So when you say diversity inclusion, are you talking about people from different racial backgrounds or people from different industries or?
Yeah, great question. I'm talking for people with different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And you can have people of color that have the same perspective as me or different perspectives as me. So again, I don't want to check that box. I want it to be meaningful. And that means it could look a lot of different ways.
I think. Right. But how could you talk about land restoration without talking to Native American tribes? You know, I'm Cherokee, but we need more. We need a more diverse group looking at the issue.
Yeah. Hmm. Have you had any?
We spent a lot of time focusing on that and learning and talking to people. And I know that's something you're passionate about as well, Cecilia.
Mm-hmm. So have you been speaking to some of the Native Indian people?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah.
And what's their view?
Continuing to just build relationships, you know, to where we really are getting to know each other. And
yeah, it requires a certain level of trust that I think, if we're being honest, has been those relationships have been poorly managed over the last several hundred years in the United States. And so it requires work. You have to build. You can't just say you want to be diverse. You have to be diverse. You have to really work on relationships and nurture those things. And so in particular, we've had some great conversations with the Osage Indians. We've had some great conversations even with a Native American that I believe is Hopi background, and multiple others. But you can't just go to these people and say, hey, what do you think? You have to really invest time and effort into those resources, and not just Native Americans, right? There are some historically Black communities, African American.
Yeah, one of our committee members represents the Black Farmers Association.
Right.
You know, and what can we do to go into these communities to bring them into our organization, not go talk to people about what they should do, you know, like you said, Stacey, but to make sure that our organization is functioning in a diverse way.
Yeah. And we, in order to do that, you can't just bring them into your community. You have to go into theirs as well. Right. And so, it takes time. It takes time. I think Brooke and I are a little frustrated with the amount of time it's taken us, because we want so desperately to be on sort of the right side of history there. We want to be better. And so it's a hard thing to do, but we are going to do it, and we're going to even if it takes us a lot of time and effort. We're sort of we see that as a tremendous opportunity to bring people together as a part of this concept. There's enough going on in the world to set people apart. We don't want to be a part of that.
So. I think this is something that I think about a lot. I'm thinking about a lot recently, and I think it's when you're talking about diversity, you're talking about reaching out to people who don't necessarily think in the same way as you do, which is where the richness comes in. But if you're talking to people who don't necessarily think the same way as you do, then it's a lot more difficult. And it just takes a lot more communication to understand each other's point of view, because it means that there is going to be a lot more conflict. There are going to be a lot more issues on which you just don't see eye to eye. And so I think it's going to take a lot of skill. As you know, people talk about diversity. Diversity doesn't mean that you have someone who looks different to you but thinks the same way as you. And there's no point right. in that. There's no point in that at all. Right. It's about having people who think differently from you. And so then how do you manage relationships with people who think differently to you? It's going to be hard. So I think,
Keep talking and being willing to devote the time. You know, you may not be able to move as quickly as you want to or as you're used to moving. But it will be a better result once you get there.
And it means that you're going to have to be dealing with disagreements with people. You don't think the same way as them. So you're disagreeing with them. So how are you going to get through that?
So back to the data part, we have to have the data part where it's factual so that we can all come together around that. We can all sort of align on fact, and then we can process it differently. But that's why that's so important. Without that to bring people to the table, it's all the more difficult.
Mm. Mm. Well, I think, I mean, what you're doing is a fantastic thing. It sounds like it's just so incredibly necessary. Just as we bring this to a close, there's two questions I'd like to ask you, and both of you. So perhaps Stacey first. Has it been a positive or a negative or a neutral to be a woman in your career and in your industry?
Well, my experience in the industry has been positive. So I think my answer is that positive. But I'll tell you why I say that. And I say that with a little reservation. I have had incredible mentors and advocates that are men, older men, younger men, all of the above. And I've had some incredible advocates that are women as well. I think that I have been given opportunities, that maybe I wouldn't have been given because I'm a woman. And I don't know how I feel about that. Right. On one hand, there's sort of this take advantage of opportunities that are given to you concept. But the why is always in the back of my mind, right? I don't want someone to give me an opportunity. And this goes to the diversity and inclusion conversation too. Nobody wants to be given an opportunity because of what they look like or, you know, any of those things. We want to be given those opportunities because we deserve them. So all of that to say my experience has been very positive, but I'm really conscious of the why behind that. And making sure that I am maybe growing and not taking advantage of opportunities that aren't deserved and passing those along to those who do deserve them, regardless of what they look like. A long-winded answer because it is a complex situation. Certainly the way we each look and behave and act and think has everything to do with our journey in life. And mine is no exception to that.
Hmm. And Brooke, what would you be?
Very difficult to answer because we know that there are fewer women on boards we see the data there, but for me, my experience has been very positive being a female and I can't, I have very few examples for you of times where I felt like someone was holding me back, or that I was affected, by being a woman. And, I'm probably a little bit skewed because Stacey and I have been working together for a really long time. And so I work for a female oil and gas CEO. So, there's plenty of opportunity, where I am, but.
Well, I mean, it's great. It's great to hear that in what you might think would be a very male dominated and potentially very chauvinistic industry, that in fact that's not everybody's experience. It's fantastic to hear that.
Yeah, and I think like Stacey said earlier, maybe starting out I only knew a couple of female engineers or geologists, and that's definitely not the case anymore.
Brooke, as you were speaking about working for a female CEO, I'm going back through my mind, my first job experience and therefore, one of my most meaningful job experiences was at Samson Energy, who is run by a female CEO. So maybe we are the exceptions to the rule, but certainly there was not a shortage of female people for me to look up to. When I think about, Stacey Schusterman, Jill Lampert, incredible advocate for me all along the way, Lisa Stewart, there are women out there that have paved the way. We're not there yet, but there were certainly people that had paved the way for me. And I suspect my experience would have been a lot different had those women not gone before me.
Oh, it's fabulous to hear. And is there anything that we haven't spoken about that either of you would like to bring up? Is there a particular message that you'd like to give to people who are listening? Anything at all that we've missed? Anything at all?
Brooke, you can go first if you have something.
Oh, I don't know that we need to circle back. One thing that I think is really, something interesting that we have been working on is incentives for people to want to do the work. And so how can we come together to provide opportunities for each other? And I know one of those for us have been working on methodology for carbon offsets. For plugging wells or you know, how can we reach out to each other and say, how can I help you with what you're doing? But I don't know that we need to entirely circle back to that. So I'll let you go, Stacey.
Well, mine is really, I'm sort of constantly very conscious of whatever image we may be portraying out there. And so, you know, I don't want the oil and gas industry to think we're anti-oil and gas. And I don't want the environmental folks to think that we're anti-environment, or regulatory folks think that we're kind of dogging on them or anything like that. I'm always real conscious of that because I think we truly, truly believe that we are not just one of those groups. And I think a lot of people in oil and gas, as it has evolved, the new look, the new thing that we all are is very much environmentalist, very much outdoors people, very much on board with supporting our regulatory staff. And that is, the oil and gas industry doesn't always do such a great job of public relations, I guess you could say. But there is a big group of people in oil and gas that, you know, look, think, talk, speak the way that Brooke and I are doing this right now. And really, I think if we can lift those people up, the sort of the world will be a better place along the way. So don't get stuck pigeonholing people, I guess, is maybe my message out.
Yeah.
Got some pretty major problems to solve, and we're not going to solve them if we don't do it together.
We were very curious when we started this, as we are approaching groups, you know, whether it's the Environmental Defense Fund or Resources for the Future or these environmental scientists, and to call and say, hello, we're from oil and gas. we thought they would like laugh us out of the room, and it's not been the case. It's never once been the case, actually, so far. We've been shocked. And so, like, don't live within your label, so to speak. If you see something that you think you could improve, just go start reaching out to people and learning about it.
Mm. And I think that circles back then to the diversity and inclusion things we were talking about a few minutes ago, that it's all about listening to other people and not pigeonholing them because of their race, their color, their industry, their sex, their whatever. It's being more open, being able to listen to what people have got to say and what they care about.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Well, thank you both. It's been a joy to speak to you and to meet you. I think what you're doing is, as I said before, is just so incredibly important. I really want to acknowledge what you're doing, because it's a non-profit. It's something that you're doing because you believe in it. It's just such a fantastic initiative. So congratulations to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Brave New Women. Certain podcast sites such as Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Podchaser let you leave a rating and a review. The more ratings and reviews we get, the more people will listen, and the more these women's stories will be shared. So I'd really appreciate it if you could. Thanks for listening.